Okay, so it's Tuesday, July 7th, 2009, and I am Johanna Russ, the AFSCME archivist, interviewing Joan Goddard. This is a telephone interview. I'm located in Detroit at the Reuther Library, and Joan is in San Jose at your house, is that correct?
Actually, I live in Campbell, but it's in the San Jose area, yes.
Okay. So she is on the West Coast, and we are going to be talking about the 1981 comparable wage campaign in San Jose. And we'll go ahead and get started. Joan, could you tell me a little bit about what you do or did for a living? What positions you've held in AFSCME and when you held them? Kind of a little timeline background.
Hey, I'm a librarian, and I was hired by San Jose Public Library in 1971 and retired in 1998. And I now work as a part-time substitute reference librarian for the Santa Clara County Library. And have enjoyed that work, and that the fact that I'm a librarian has a lot to do with the fact with my being involved in the comparable worth effort in San Jose. And as far as AFSCME, in the late 1970s, I was asked to be secretary, to run for secretary of Local 101, and I didn't realize I'd have no opposition. But I became, so my first active role in the union was to be secretary at the Local 101 level, which is the legal level that does not do any active representation of employees or negotiation for them, but is a sort of an umbrella level of the organization for involving the representatives from the different chapters in different jurisdictions, cities, and school districts around our county. And then soon after I became secretary of the Local 101 Board, I joined the board of MEF, the Municipal Employees Federation, which is the San Jose City Employees Chapter of Local 101, representing a lot of the city employees, but not by any means all of them. And in 1980, during the pay study, comparable worth study committee's work, I was on the negotiating team. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. That was part of what led up to the strength that led us to the strike. Then I was elected to the pay study negotiating team in December of 1980, that same year, and continued pay study negotiating team continued then along with the regular contract negotiating team in the spring of 1981. And after the strike, I was on negotiating teams through the 1980s, not every year, but as our contracts would come up for renegotiation periodically. And also fairly soon became MEF president, which I did with the idea that I would be able to help make sure that we continue to work on comparable worth salary adjustments until we reached our goal. And after I'd been MEF president for a couple of two-year terms, I believe, I became Local 101 president for a couple of terms in the late 1980s into the early 1990s. I may have those dates slightly off, but
that's
the general idea.
Wow. That's quite a lot. So MEF was a chapter within Local 101.
Right.
Okay. And the City Women for Advancement and the Coalition of Library Activist Workers, were those separate groups or affiliated with Local 101? How did that work?
They were separate groups, and they included people who were not necessarily active union members, and in some cases not technically union members, but were represented by MEF and Local 101.
Okay.
And the City Women for Advancement included some library employees, but not all of us who were active in the union were involved with that organization. It included a lot of the women clerical workers in the city, and also specifically in the city attorney's office, as well as other city hall offices, and as I said, some library and probably some recreation workers also. And then the Coalition for Library Activist Workers, CLAW, CLAW, was a group that became active when there were some threats to library services, and worked in conjunction with community groups, Friends of the Library, etc., but also independently and pretty much independently of the union, although many of us who were active in the union were also part of CLAW.
Okay. Great.
Okay. I think those were the main active groups.
Okay. And what made you become involved in union leadership and the pay equity issue? Was there anything in your youth or your parents, any kind of role model like that that encouraged you to become involved in the justice work?
Well, my mother was active in the League of Women Voters, and she also did some work as far as jail library service, which I became involved with also, not as a person providing the service, but as a support and organizing person within library associations. Part of that, but before that I had been active in the civil rights and peace movement, and my grandfather was in the carpenter's union.
Great. Okay.
But I think the work, as far as comparable work, grew out of being active in the union.
Okay.
Rather than becoming active in the union because of the equal pay issue.
Okay. Cool. So, can you talk a little bit about the comparable wage efforts leading up to the Hay Study?
Yes.
Okay.
As we said, the City Women for Advancement was an organization that had been encouraged and organized by Maxine Jenkins, who was the union representative, the staff person for MEF in the late 1970s. Mm-hmm. And she had come from SEIU in San Francisco, where she had been very active in starting to educate herself and other people about the issue of equal pay for women's work, comparable work, or pay equity. Called a lot of different terms.
Right.
And then she left SEIU and became an AFSCME staff person, and was assigned to the San Jose Local 101, and particularly to MEF. So she was working with the City Women for Advancement, and they did quite a large project. Again, a few library employees were involved with it, but I was not. And they made a presentation to the city council that in 1978, before the Proposition 13 election and so on, and that was called Women Working for It. And I got a note here about it that said, they were talking about eliminating sex discrimination from pay and personnel practices of the city of San Jose. And the union aspect to that was, in addition to the City Women for Advancement, was the MEF Affirmative Action Committee. And they presented this paper, which included a section about the Carlsbad School District in Southern California, where there had been a comparable work study and salary adjustment. So this was very encouraging and educational for a lot of the City Women for Advancement, about the same time, were concerned that they were not getting a good response from the city and the city council. And so the police were having their contract negotiations in the spring of 1978, and they, the City Women for Advancement group, again, not really involving the library people very much at all, scheduled or organized themselves to be sick on the same day that the police had blue flu, they called it. So there was a sick out of clerical workers, basically secretaries and both types in City Hall on the same day that the police had a sick out or in relation to their contract negotiations. And this was right around the same time that the city manager had decided to study the management positions, jobs in the city of San Jose, because he felt that the salaries were not based on the logical practices, and that they should look at the overall setup of the salaries so that they could recruit good people to work in management in the city. And so when the city, after the blue flu and Women's Sick Out Day, the city council fairly soon actually was looking at the, okaying a study for the management classifications in the city. And Maxine Jenkins and others went to the city council meeting and spoke up in demanding that there also be a study for non-management, of the non-management classifications. And with some short resistance, I guess, or whatever, but that this did happen within a fairly short period of time that the city agreed to do what turned out to be the Hay Study, the comparable work study. So this process then of doing the Hay Study included all of the city employees, because it was not just our union people that we represented, but all the city employees who were being studied, I believe, with the exception of police and fire. And so that included architects and engineers, that included the outdoor gardening, etc., workers that were represented by the laborers union, I believe, and some other categories. And in the process of doing the study, they did the process where you have everyone describe their jobs and answer a lot of questions about them and so on. And our union did some workshops to help people be sure that we did a good job with describing our jobs, etc. And had circulated some information to people about it, about this kind of study, and then worked very hard to be sure that the committee that did the actual job evaluation was set up in a good way, because the original idea was that the various departments in the city would send their personnel person or someone representing the department and would be on the study. And it was not necessarily going to result in something that the employees could accept and believe was accurate, because they were not, if the department management decides who's going to be involved with this, and it's all sort of from the city administration point of view, without any active involvement by people recognized by the other employees as knowing what the jobs are really all about, because they are people who are doing those jobs, then it was going to be difficult to hope that it would be done as well as it could be done, and that it would be accepted and believed in by the employees afterwards.
Right.
So that was at one point one of the earliest things that I knew about that happened that was something that helped to make the study go very well was the setting up of that committee, in addition to the workshops that were being done and the information that was being shared. And the I believe that there was a meeting, an informal meeting with Maxine Jenkins and one or two of the union leaders who happened to be library people, and they were talking with one of the city council members, Iola Williams, whom we had helped to get appointed to the city council, about this idea that it should be representative of the employees, including some who were suggested by the union, along with city human resources people and others would do the actual evaluation of the jobs and ranking of them and so on. So in other words, there was a lot of involvement over a period of time, and leading up to the negotiations itself was then the actual job evaluation, and we were getting reports from our representatives on the Hague Study Committee, and helping them to be strong and encouraging them and so on and so forth. I'm not sure how much further. Oh, yes. Another major thing that happened that was part of the growing awareness and involvement was that we were doing contract negotiations in 1980 at the time that the Hague Study Committee was doing their work. The management Hague Study was a little less complex because there were fewer jobs in the city administration at the management level. There were fewer jobs to study, and they did have, again, representatives from among those occupation or those classification levels and so on their committee. But it was a smaller committee and it was fewer jobs, and they finished theirs earlier. So that when we were nearing the end of our contract negotiations in 1980, and I was on that negotiating team, the MEF negotiations were coming to a close about at the same time that the management pay study was finished, and the city's negotiators told us that it had been completed and they would be looking at it and acting on it with the city council, and that ours would probably not be finished until sometime late in the year, late in 1980, and that after they looked at it, they would let us know whether they wanted to discuss it with us. Now that created quite a stir, and the response of our negotiator was, our staff negotiator, who by then was Bill Callahan, because Maxine Jenkins had left our union staff by then. Bill Callahan said, "What did you say? We understand what you said." Because, of course, we were going to negotiate about the results of the Hague Study. And so the city's negotiator repeated that, and we said, "Well, if that's your position, then we need to leave the negotiating table until you agree to negotiate with us about it." And so we left, and we found a book that we said were at impasse about this. And we found a book that was political cartoons called A Political Bestiary, and one of them was a moose. And the moose stands firm and does not give in. So our union mascot became the moose. And we picketed at City Hall. And then within a week or so, the city actually announced the adjustments, salary adjustments they were going to make in the management level. And the library management level were appropriately going to get huge increases because they had been underpaid just like the rest of us through the years. And so the newspaper came out. The headlines talked about it. Our negotiating team went to the, actually I can't remember what office it was, whether it was the city negotiator or the city manager, probably the city manager's office, and Bill Callahan threw a copy of the paper on the desk and said, "We will be negotiating with you about this for the non-management people." And so then we fairly soon got back to the negotiating table, and obviously the city's position was not very tenable, and finished our negotiations for that year, and then awaited the results of the non-management pay study so that we could get started with that same city council that had decided to do the study. Was many of some of them were going out of office in January of 1981, so we wanted to get our first meeting with the city about the non-management pay study results in that while they were still in office, and we did accomplish that. There's more, of course, through the spring of 1981, but we can probably talk about that later.
Okay. You mentioned a few things I wanted to go back and ask about. You mentioned that as part of the things you had been looking at for examples and for models, you saw that the Carlsbad School District had done a job evaluation study and had implemented adjustments for pay equity. Was that a union campaign?
I'm sorry, I don't know.
You don't know? Okay, that's fine. But presumably there was no strike. Since your strike is commonly referred to as the first pay equity strike. So
right, they did not go out on strike.
Okay.
Sure about that.
And do you know what caused the city council to begin the study of the management job classifications in the first place?
My understanding is it was because the city manager felt that the salaries were not at an appropriate level.
Okay.
Management, and not particularly with the idea of women's occupational fields like library and recreation and so on, but just overall, in general, that they were not at an appropriate level, and he was looking for a personnel evaluation analysis method, and learned about the Hay Associates and their methods of assessing jobs, and also then looking at the market in relation to those in addition, and felt that that would be a good method.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that he had in mind raising library and recreation and city clerk, office of the city clerk, a manager, and so on, about that their salaries would increase dramatically as a result of this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned Maxine Jenkins a few times. Can you talk about, you've talked about her role already. Do you think this would have gotten off the ground if you hadn't had a leader like her come in, or do you think there was already something fomenting?
I definitely don't think it would have.
Okay.
Not at that time, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
There were things going on around the state and around the country that were helping with this. But, for instance, in the California Library Association, there were some programs where people who had been working in this general area, learning about it and writing about it, had folk, and also the state commission on the status of women did a series of three or four hearings around the state about it also, and those may very well have, Maxine may very well have been involved in helping to get those going too, because she had been working in San Francisco on the concept of comparable work back in the early to mid-70s. And so the fact that these things were happening, also there was some attention around the country, but I don't remember exactly what the I don't have any examples of what was happening, nor do I know where the leadership on this or the push for it was actually coming from.
Okay. Can you talk about the Proposition 13 in California and what role that played in the lead up to the negotiations and the strike?
When Proposition 13 passed, the property taxes were cut and were not going to be increasing very rapidly over a long period of time. And this was very devastating to a lot of city and county governments. And one of the things that the state did was to provide some bailout money, they called it, I believe. But the governor, Jerry Brown, at the time, they required that in order to get this money from the state, that cities and counties agreed not to have any salary increases for their employees for some period of time, at least 1 or 2 years. And so we had not had any general salary increases, although, of course, inflation was going on. And, you know, all the reasons that you need to increase salaries were still true, but at least we did not have as many layoffs as we might have had otherwise. But so there had been no general salary increases since Proposition 13 passed in June of 1978. And that meant that by the time we got to 1981, there were a lot of deferred increases in general salaries, and the financial situation was somewhat better than in the cities and counties, so that they were starting to make general salary increases around the Bay Area and throughout California. And traditionally, the city and the union have agreed to use the nearest public jurisdictions, the cities and counties closest to us in the Bay Area, as the labor market for city employees to compare, so that if we felt that particular classification job salary was out of line, then we were required to compare with these similar classifications in other neighboring jurisdictions in the labor market for that particular kind of work. And so the fact that other jurisdictions around us were getting significant salary increases, and our salary increases were unusually high also, was to make up for this lost period of time between 1981, when we had not had any general salary increases. Kind of information you wanted, or was there something else?
Yeah, no, that's great. Wasn't the Proposition 13 overturned by a court?
No, still in effect.
Okay, I must have read something different, sorry.
Very much of an effect, mm-hmm. both for individual families who stay in the same house that they have been in since the 1970s, and also for city and county governments who do not get as much property tax as they would, both from residential, because only when a house is sold does the property tax go up to an appropriate and reasonable level. Otherwise, it's quite low, which is nice for the people who stay in their home, but decreases what the money is that's available. And the other major problem is that the commercial property is handled the same way. So the business office buildings and commercial buildings and so on there's a way that they have worked out not to technically sell them. And so their property taxes do not increase, and there is not any way near the amount of property tax coming into the cities and counties that would be appropriate from business offices and sales markets and limited commercial property.
Right. Okay, I must have read something incorrectly about that. Sorry.
That's my understanding.
Okay. So, when were the non-management results released?
I think it was approximately November, but I'm not sure, of 1981.
1981 or 1980? Sorry, I didn't hear you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, okay. And so, once they were released, you started negotiating immediately?
That they were going to be released fairly soon. And so we had started working on selecting the negotiating team to work with the city about the results. And we had the first meeting before the end of December 1980.
Okay.
And we worked quite a bit to prepare for that. Tell me what you're talking about, too.
Sure. Go right ahead and tell me about those preparations.
Okay. I'm getting a drink of water.
Okay.
There we go. What was your last question?
You said you'd be happy to talk about the preparations you made going into the negotiations at the end of 1980.
When the non-management hay study was released, we looked at it, and one of the major things that it included was a graph which had indications of predominantly male and predominantly female classifications. All the different classifications indicated that way with symbols, and also an indication of the ones that were fairly balanced and not 70% or more either male or female.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Hay Associates firm had calculated what they called a trend line, which was basically an average of salaries in about 10 or 12 different job groups that were where the committee had found a group of classifications and a variety of occupations to be essentially equal in their complexity in terms of skills required, responsibility, working conditions, etc. And so if you imagine a graph where there are 10 or 12 columns, vertical columns, and each of them has some plus marks and some zeros and some minus marks or something, three different symbols for the different predominantly male, female, or balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a line that starts at the lower left with the lower salary levels. Classifications are at the beginning at the left-hand side of this group of columns. And it rises quite somewhat to the right, where the higher levels of complexity of jobs are in a column. And this was using a linear regression formula, I believe it's called, so that the line, it becomes a line rather than a zigzag as the salaries rise. And this was the sort of the average salary line. Well, this average salary line is made up of the salaries of appropriately paid predominantly male classifications, occupations, and, as opposed to that, inappropriately paid, underpaid, predominantly female occupations, classifications. And so this trend line is interesting, but it has nothing to do with where salaries ought to be. Because the male, this is our position, and I believe it's true, the male occupations are paid appropriately. They're not overpaid. The city's not paying them more than they have to pay them in the labor market. And so those are the ones that are appropriately paid. Some of them are paid pretty high for various reasons, but when you average them out, which is what we did, you can do a trend line of the predominantly male classification. And that's what we are had as our goal. That male average salary line is the goal for the other classifications and occupations to move towards. Whereas the city heard the case study people say, okay, this is the trend line, the average trend line, and we're going to put a line 15% above it and 15% below it so that you have sort of a range above and below the average. And it's true that many, many employers have occupations and are employees whose salaries are outside of this cone of whatever they called it, the 15% above and below the average line. Those of us who, the city had an unusually large number below, and I don't know whether they said there were an unusually large number above, but I don't think so. So the city was looking at this 15% below the trend line and thinking that was their goal. And that was so far from the average male salary line that it provided quite an outrage to us. Mm-hmm. that they would think that if they raised the very lowest salary up to 15% below the average salary line, which means nothing in terms of where salary should be really, that would be some, you know, that could be what they would do. And that was their position, as it turned out. So, but in the meantime, we had figured out this male trend line, and we're presenting that as our goal, and that was our preparation for the first meeting with the city's negotiators about the Hay Study.
So just to clarify, you were the Hay Study and the city was operating from a trend line of a general overall average that included the very underpaid job classifications, and you with the union were operating from a trend line that only included the male-dominated appropriately paid classifications.
I believe so. I don't think we included the balanced classes, but we may have. But I'm pretty sure that we just went with the male-dominated, predominantly male classifications and occupations.
Okay. So you went into this meeting with two different trend lines.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Of course, theirs was the quote official one because it was part of the Hay Study report.
Right. Right. And so, how did you come to an agreement?
Well, we didn't.
Right.
We never came to an agreement on the mail.
Okay.
Actually, the city also did not have their regular contract negotiator meet with us at first. I don't remember whether he was ill or busy with other union negotiations or what was going on, but for some reason the city had a management person in the personnel department meet with us, and as the representative of the city. And his instructions were to hold the line at the 15% below the trend line. And he described it, I believe, as a brick wall, which gave us quite a bit, again, of motivation and energy to try to break through that brick wall. And so when we kept meeting with them and we kept educating our members, and we weren't getting anywhere in the spring, early spring of 1981, we realized that we had a real problem and we needed to start looking at the possibility of some kind of public action. And we did some picketing and we did flyers and so on and so forth, and we also got to a point where we had started the regular salary negotiations probably in April or so with additional union members on the negotiating team for that, and the combined teams always met together ourselves and also with the city from then on. And so when it was clear that the city was not ready to negotiate at a reasonable, you know, looking, not everything to happen in the first year or something like that, but to plan for salary increases over a period of time, over the period of the contract, and then with the understanding that we would look at it again when the next contract negotiations came up, for a long time they were not willing to go beyond that 15% below the trend line, their pay study trend line. And so we eventually, we took a strike vote in the union, I believe in May, and we got strike sanction from the Central Labor Council towards the end of May, I believe. And our contract was to expire at the end of June. So we were starting then, after the strike vote and the strike sanction from the Labor Council, we were starting a countdown kind of thing, where every few days we would send out a progress or lack of progress report on flyers to the employees.
Did you involve other community groups in this campaign? Did you get support from the community, from the international unions, anything like that?
I don't know what kinds of discussions there were with the international union staff and officers and so on. I was on the negotiating team, but I was not hearing a lot about that, but I remember, and I don't know what was happening as far as that was concerned. I know that we did work with some women's groups in Santa Clara County, and the Commission on the Status of Women, I believe, at the county, although I'm not sure about that, but there were several women's organizations in Santa Clara County who publicly supported us and came to public meetings and talked with city council members and so on. And I unfortunately don't remember the names of those organizations right now.
That's okay.
Members to include them.
And in June of 1981, the Supreme Court decided a court case, County of Washington, Oregon versus Gunther. How did that affect your campaign?
It affected our campaign in the earlier stages of that case, there were decisions along the way that I think what must have been happening was that we knew that there had been probably a federal district court or some kind of appeals court level decision in favor of the women jail workers in that county, represented as Gunther as one of them in the case. And so we knew that there was this case that was proceeding that had to do with not exactly equal jobs, like equal pay for equal work, involved two people sitting practically side by side doing exactly the same work over the same period of time, or at least the woman has been working on it just as long as the man has, and yet the woman is getting less pay. And this was not exactly that kind of situation because their jobs were somewhat different. It wasn't really a comparison of men's work versus women's work, unless you consider male guards guarding men, men's work, and women's guards guarding women, women's work. But that's not what we need when we talk about women's work and men's work. We talk about completely different occupations, comparing them. Ones that are predominantly female or predominantly male at the point at which you are looking at them, posted historically. So by the time by the time the Supreme Court of the United States ruled on the Gunther case, we were well into our negotiations, and it really didn't have that particular Supreme Court decision did not have any do with our, other than just sort of reinforcing a little bit our, okay, good, something good happened, that's good, kind of situation. But it was the lower level decisions on that case that would have been part of what was helping to, not strengthen us exactly, but encourage us, because it wasn't really a comparable worth of case.
Right. Following the Supreme Court decision, didn't the union file a claim with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission?
No, I don't know how much it was related.
Okay.
It may have been, and it probably was following it. I think what happened was that the city was not, until sometime well into June, they were still at this 15% below the average trend line level as far as what they were willing to do about salary adjustments in that particular contract. And that was not, and then they wouldn't even talk about what they'd do in the future. And this was probably going to be a 2-year contract. So they were not really bargaining with us as we thought it should be done in regard to the results of the Hay Study. And so we felt that we needed to keep doing things that would give us other avenues or would put more pressure on them or whatever. That's the way I remember, to a certain extent, but mostly looking back, trying to figure out. And I don't have my notes about from the negotiations or the discussions, so I don't. I may have them, but I don't have them. I have not looked at them in the last however many years. So I don't know whether I have any notes about it or not. But my feeling is that what we would have been doing was to just add one more angle of pressure. Okay, if you're not going to negotiate with us about this realistically and appropriately, considering the fact that one library management employee had gotten a 25% salary increase, and others had gotten significant ones.
Right.
So we're comparing what they're doing with the non-management people at the negotiating table and refusing to do with what they did with the management people less than a year before.
Right.
And so that was another major injustice factor, and did, you know, to lead to our indignation and so on. And so filing with the EEOC was another tool that we could use to, I believe, to try to emphasize to the city that, you know, there are a lot of avenues that we have, and well, not a lot, but there are some other avenues that we have, and we're going to be using all the ones that we possibly can if you're not going to be appropriately negotiating with us about them. They said that we were using an unfair labor practice to do that, but they were using a far more unfair labor practice by refusing to treat the non-management employees in an appropriate manner compared with the management employees.
Okay. We've kind of mentioned this a little bit in our discussion so far, but let's talk a little more in detail about some of the arguments from opponents. We mentioned briefly, you know, equal opportunity legislation, equal pay for equal work instead, affirmative action. Can you kind of talk about some of those arguments and how you and the union countered them?
And also market forces?
Right, yes, market forces, exactly.
Yeah, okay, so the three aspects of salary setting or salary patterns that might emerge for women and employed women. The market forces are what has been used. I mentioned that we're required to look at other public jurisdictions in our general area. That's the labor market, and those jurisdictions also have salaries that were set based on both the public and the private sector's practice of paying women as little as they could get away with and paying men likewise as little as they could get away with, but much more appropriately. And part of that came from strong men's work, labor unions, of course, in the past. And so the market forces or not, we're just going to continue to do, to have the same effect on our salaries. And there was not a way to improve the women's salaries unless you, you know, organized all the women across the whole geographic area, whatever.
Right.
And we all had a giant, you know, sit down or whatever, and that was not at all likely to happen.
Right.
And also I think that we needed some sort of rational basis other than just you're paying us too little. But when we were able to see from the Hay study that you could actually, and that personnel people do analyze jobs, they do compare apples and oranges, you can compare men's work jobs and women's work jobs and break them down into categories and so on and so forth. So once that was done, then it was possible for us to say that this is not a situation that's covered by the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and the earlier Equal Pay Act or whatever it was called in California from, I don't know, 1949 or something. And it had been 30 years since California passed an Equal Pay for Equal Work law, and then the federal one was passed in 1963, and the Civil Rights Act follows that. But those had to do with whether women librarians and men librarians are paid the same amount, not whether the librarians were paid an appropriate amount compared to the engineers and the planners and various other men's work occupations. And so the Equal Pay for Equal Work Act, even though the discussion during the legislation consideration period for those included comparable work, that it was not clearly included in that legislation, and now we're still trying to get that fixed with the Fair Pay Act in Congress and so on and so forth. So equal pay for equal work was not relevant to the situation. And as far as the suggestion that many people make that, gee, the way to solve the problem of the women's wage gap so that there will be higher average salaries or median salaries for women across the board compared with men across the board is for women to go into men's work jobs. And that's fine. And there are some women who want to do that, and they usually encounter a lot of resistance from the men in the jobs, but they persist, and that's wonderful. But the problem with that as a solution is it might increase the median salaries for women if that were totally successful. But that doesn't have anything to do with what the salaries are for what is now predominantly done by women, which is valuable work. If you look at women's work jobs, they tend to be working with people, whether it's teachers, nurses, librarians, recreation, clerical staff, secretaries, so on, social workers, et cetera, women's work jobs. Those are very important jobs, and working with people in some ways is a lot more complicated, a lot more difficult, and a lot more important than fixing a car, which is pretty straightforward when you think about it, compared with working with people. But the fixing the car gets a really good salary, and working with people does not. And that is a big part of what this whole thing is about, besides the money that women and their families and men who do women's work as well and their families not just women, it's women's work, because there are a lot of male librarians who don't get paid what they should be getting paid. So the suggestion that women go into non-traditional fields is fine, and some have done it, and we try to encourage people to do that so that they can cope with all of the negativity and things that you see in movies like the one about the woman in Minnesota who went into mining work. The name of it right now?
Yeah, I can't remember it either.
Anyway, wonderful, very good, you know, story, and very inspiring, and there have been projects around here in the Labor Council. I mean, the Building Trades Council has a woman who works to encourage women to go into the building trades and to recruit them and to work with them, and they actually have someone who's paid to do that. And these are all wonderful things, but that's not going to improve the salaries for women's work, teachers, nurses, social workers, librarians, clerical staff, recreation workers, social workers, et cetera, which is what we need to have happen. And what they have done in Minnesota, across the state, all public jurisdictions, all school districts, special districts, cities, counties, state level, they did studies, they adjusted salaries, and every either 2 or 3 years, they're required to review the situation at each jurisdiction and make a report to a state office and to show how they're going to correct any problems that have arisen in the meantime. And that is what we need across the entire country. In every state. A lot of work to get towards that.
Yeah.
But that was negotiated by me.
Well, we've been going for about an hour. Do you need a break or anything?
Well, that would probably be good.
Okay. Should I call you back in about 10 minutes?
Okay. That sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Drink some more water.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye. We're back from our break, and we were trying to go somewhat chronologically, but I was reading over the questions during the break and realized there's one that we missed. It was in the new question list, so you might not have seen it yet, but in my reading, I read a lot about an internal union struggle in the late 70s among public works employees and sort of the librarian faction, if you will. Can you talk about that at all?
Okay, and there are two aspects to that, one of which I don't know a lot about, which was before I became involved, and because I became involved after several library employees who were stewards in the union decided that they wanted to have a larger role and for other people other than, I guess, that my understanding now is that the public works, that the people who were running the union before were primarily public works employees, which I was not aware of that situation. I just knew that there were a group of people who were running the union, and at some point, I mean, I heard later that this had happened, that there were people in the union, stewards, and there were also some stewards who were not library people. And in fact, probably, I don't know whether they were like clerical workers or, but one of the women later became a construction inspector for the city. And that group of stewards is the way I understood it. These stewards for people other than the departments where most of the union leadership was coming from, which I guess was the Public Works Department, apparently, they decided to take over the union, and or at least have some of their people, and you know, elected to the board and offices and so on. And they were successful in doing that, perhaps beyond their original intent or whatever. And so there was a major change in union leadership in the mid 70s, shortly before I got involved in the union. So I don't really know very much about that, but I've been learning more as I read some of the books that give background on the strike and so on and so forth. the thing that happened during the strike, which we could talk about later if you want, or during the lead up to the strike and to the negotiations, was that some of those public works and surveyors and construction inspectors and so on became part of the negotiating team, and we worked well with them. Okay. So I can talk about that now or later.
Sure, you can go ahead since you're on that.
There were several people who could be considered either technically part of public works or part of departments that had been split off when public works was divided into more than one department. And the ones that I remember the most, the two or three people, were men who were able to understand the situation and to see that it was part of family income, that this movement could affect, you know, their spouses, other men's spouses, and so on, and realized that this was something that was a good thing. And also, we were always very clear, as I mentioned earlier, that men's work salaries were at an appropriate level, not, quote, too high on average, as many people tried to say, well, the reason that women's work is underpaid and seems to be underpaid is because men's work is paid too much. And that was never the position of the union, and it was never, and it was very clearly something that we were not about to do anything in terms of holding, I've forgotten what term they use now, but there's a term that has to do with holding a particular classification salary levels without increases when other classification level salaries are increased, you know, because there's an assessment made that somehow the city has let these salaries for some of the classifications get too high. And our position was always that the city had not done that. The city was paying what they needed to pay to have good employees in men's work jobs, and therefore we were not at all willing to look at even to consider the possibility that those salaries should be held or somehow decreased over time or whatever in order to let the women's occupation jobs increase to a level that was closer to them.
Did the city negotiators ever suggest that as one solution?
I don't recall that they did, but they probably said it at some point, and we quickly said no, that's not, you know, appropriate or possible.
So you had the support of male union members because of this?
We also, whenever we heard that there were problems, we tried to go and talk to people. If we heard any inkling that there were concerns or whatever. And, you know, some men are very aware and knowledgeable and sensible. And they were involved.
Yeah. Great. So, leading up to the actual strike, it seems there were two things at work. There were the wage adjustments as a result of the Hay studies, and then there was the normal cost of living increase that you said had not happened for several years because of Proposition 13.
Yeah.
So what actually pushed you to strike? Were both of those things in play, or had some of it been settled?
What pushed us to strike was the fact that the city would not negotiate for so long, for several months. They would not realistically negotiate about comparable worth adjustments over a period of time. Therefore, after we started the general contract negotiations, that was still going on for a month or two, a couple months, I'm pretty sure, and that was when we realized that we might be looking at a situation where we might have to go out on strike. because they were not negotiating with us about our major issue at that point. And so what we did was we prepared to go out on strike, primarily based on their city's refusal to negotiate appropriately about the Hay Study. And once we had a strike vote on that issue and strike sanction from the Central Labor Council on that issue, at some point in June, after we had done those things late in May, I believe, at some point in June, the city finally started negotiating with us about a two-year plan to raise salaries somewhat beyond the 15% line, 15% below the trend line, and to do a two-year batch of improvements, which were significant improvements. I can't remember exactly what the numbers were, but as it turned out, by the end of the strike, there was some adjustment for some of the classifications that would have gotten huge increases. I think it was the archivists at the museum would have gotten huge increases, even larger than the city management people had, just to get them to the point where the rest of us were going to be on a, you know, on a level. And they managed to talk our leadership out of that and to have a maximum of a 15% increase each year for the 2 years of the contract. But before the strike, I believe that's about at the point where we were, except that we didn't have this 15% maximum aspect to it. And we weren't really at the point of having an agreement exactly. But we were very far along on the general, on the comparable worth changes that would be made, salary increases, before, say, a week or so before the strikes started. At some point during June, the city started talking about how they were going to take these salary increases for comparable worth out of the general salary increase pot. And we and some of the city council members were pushing for the fact that this was really a separate situation, that there needed to be a separate batch of money that was designated to be used then soon and over a period of time to put money into a fund that could be used to improve women's work salaries, and that this had nothing to do with general inflationary needs of increasing general salary levels in the city for everybody, so that there should be a general salary increase for everybody, including the women's work people, and that the comparable worth adjustments were a separate matter and needed to be separately funded. And the city would not agree to that, to setting up some kind of a fund like that. And they were offering us, at the very last minute in the negotiations, significantly less in the way of a general salary increase compared with the other jurisdictions. Like Alameda County had gotten a 9% salary increase, general salary increase, and one or two other cities or counties, major cities or counties in the area, had settled their, finished their negotiations and were getting around that level. Again, the only reason they were that large is because we hadn't had any salary increases for 3 years since the, or actually probably 4 years since before Proposition 13, but that was when the restriction was placed on it, so that our negotiations in 1978 were not successful in getting salary increases because of these restrictions from the state. So we could not take a salary, I mean a contract that gave our overall, made our overall general salary increase for all of us so much less than the neighboring jurisdictions. That was not appropriate. And it was a two-year contract that was proposed, and it would have been the same 6% each year. whereas I don't know whether the other jurisdictions were 1 or 2 year contracts, but they were, as I said, about the 9% level, and that was absolutely not something that we could do. And that is technically why we went out on strike, why we had to go on strike. But in actuality, it was all the whole process and the whole situation and how they interacted and didn't interact in our minds, but in the city's minds, there was this pot of money and it had to be divided between general increases and comparable worth increases, and that was not appropriate when the comparable worth situation was something that really had nothing to do with the general salary increase needs and why you need to make them and so on and so forth, and had everything to do with a long-standing underpayment of women's work by the city and all other employers, which means that library services, et cetera, are being financed by the people who work in those jobs and their families, in part, because we didn't get, and still don't really get, totally appropriate salaries.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's pretty much what, unless there's some other aspect of it that you were wondering about.
No, that's perfect. So then you did go out on strike. Can you tell me about the strike itself? Did you picket? What was the mood among union members who participated? How did those, was it 9 days or 10 days, I think, go?
Let's see, the total, we started on early, in the middle of the night, Saturday night, technically, although most of us weren't scheduled to work till Monday, but we started picketing, and it ended, I believe, we went back to work on Wednesday, but it might have been Tuesday, a week and a half later, and some jobs, you know, go through the weekend, and so we were picketing all the time, and so on. And I did not actually do any picketing. I was on the negotiating team, and the job that I got was every morning I would start out fairly early, and I would go and get, and maybe sometimes the day before, but in any case, I would get soda pop from a store, and I would go to an ice company that would happen to be called Union Ice, and I would get huge bags of ice, and I would go to 2, 3, 4 different locations where there were garbage cans, plastic garbage cans that we would put the soda and the ice in, at the places like City Hall and some other places where there were large numbers of picketers. I didn't go around to every public library or every recreation center that had pickets and so on. And then, because I was on the negotiating team, I needed to report to the union office, even if we weren't negotiating that day. That was, you know, where we were supposed to go and work on things and so on. So I was not actually on a picket line, but there seemed to be a really good mood as far as I could tell, and interacting with people when I brought the sodas. Sometimes they didn't like the fact that I brought store brand sodas instead of Coke and Pepsi and so on. But other than that, that was mostly joking around.
Yeah.
And the one story that I really remember from the picketers was that at the airport, there were a few picketers, and at least one of them was a library employee, and she told us about how wonderful it felt when the Teamster truck drivers drove up to their picket line and turned their trucks around and left. And that was very heartening and positive, and solidarity was wonderful.
Right. That's great.
Is there anything else about that? We did communicate, of course, by both people going to the picket line places, and there was a major activity that happened after the first week when the city manager sent out letters to all of us who were not working, as far as they could tell, and told us that if we didn't report for work, they would use the use the provision in the civil service rules, I believe, that if an employee has not been at work for some particular number of days without calling in, reporting sick or whatever, then the person could be fired. And so this was the warning letter about the fact that they might do that, and we had an action at the city hall in front of where the city manager's office was in city hall, and had a barbecue grill, and we took our letters and we burned them. They were in front of city hall, and we have the ashes of those still in a plastic urn.
Wow. That's quite a souvenir.
That was part of, building up our morale and keeping us from getting too weirded out by such threats.
Right. So the strike was called off and negotiations resumed, or how
is that? No. We finished the negotiations and got the agreement of the city council after a little setback. We finally got their agreement before, I believe we got the city council's agreement before the strike ended.
Okay.
Yeah, because, and actually the assistant, I think she was the assistant city manager, was involved in the final negotiations. There was a point at which the cities, we were negotiating at a hotel meeting rooms or something, and negotiating around the clock, so we had, sleeping rooms also in this hotel. And at some point in that round-the-clock kind of negotiation, the city's veteran negotiator agreed to a particular package, which he, from all indications, this was something that he was authorized to agree to, because that's the standard. That was the standard procedure with him. And so we did not, we felt that that was, we had an agreement and we were very happy, but that probably happened on something like on a late Saturday night, and and the city council was meeting on Sunday afternoon about the strike and to look at what the current situation was. I believe that was the situation anyway, and the timing. And so they met, and we got word that they had turned down this agreement that their negotiator had made with us. And we were together, or some of us, and the rest got together, and a bunch of people went over to the city hall where they were meeting, and we went into the room. And one of the strange things was that they had zucchini on their long meeting room table. Like somebody had brought their extra squash from the garden to share with the other members of the city council, and they had it on the table for people to take after the meeting, which seemed bizarre. Anyway, the women mayor was very upset that we came into the meeting, and most of us didn't actually go into the room, but a few representatives did. And so then after they came out from the meeting and told us that this really was what had happened, we stood along the stairway in the lobby of the city hall, which has a wonderful sound quality to it, and sang union songs. But eventually what we did was some people went and did a candlelight vigil at the mayor's house that evening, and then we went back to negotiating again eventually.
So a lot of the articles and book chapters that I read, talk about the strike and leading up to the strike in great detail, but they don't talk much about after the strike and after 1981. And I know negotiations continued for several contract periods after that, and you continued to bring job classifications up to the line. Can you talk about that? You said you were on the negotiating teams for many years.
And as I said, I became president so I could help to keep it as a priority. So we had a 2-year contract agreement, and it probably within about a year and a half, we were actively preparing for the next negotiations. And we did make some additional adjustments during that subsequent contract negotiations. And then, I'm not sure whether that happened for two more or exactly how it went, but it sort of slowed down. And, of course, the city was still not accepting our premise that the male trend line, male occupations trend line, was the goal. And so it was hard to, you know, build up the momentum again within the union. And there were other things that were happening that we were working on, which I can't remember what they were now. But, we did continue to make adjustments, and then at some point I was no longer on negotiating teams, and they were working on it. But there was some point at which perhaps we had a three-year contract, and then at the end of that time, it had been a significant length of time since the Hay study was done. So the city and the union asked for an update on the Hay study, and that was not done in a very thorough manner, but it was somewhat of an update, and it was more of an update as far as what had been accomplished than whether there had been a lot of changes in classifications. You know, didn't get into that kind of depth. So that was the point probably at which we felt, well, it's been this long and we need to review the classifications as well. And that was very difficult to get accomplished, and at that point I had stopped being on the negotiating teams or actively involved for personal reasons, and others were trying to carry on, and some others who had been actively involved in the process earlier on had either gone into management or had left the city employment to go to work for the union, or for various reasons, those who had been some of the most involved people were no longer available to help to focus it. And so for that and various other reasons, no doubt the progress slowed down, and the people who were interested in the subject and were on the negotiating teams were not able to keep it as a high enough priority compared with other things that other union members were pushing to work on. So it slowed down, I believe, in the late 80s, and there was probably a recession in there. We were threatened with losing jobs, so that made it hard to work on this. That's probably what happened, right? Mm-hmm. One of those good old recessions that we have so often these days.
Yes.
So the city and the union have not, they have worked on it since then, and there have been particular, they've used somewhat different methods. Sometimes there were classifications that happened to be predominantly female, which were out of line with what is now the labor market around here, because of the fact that the county of Santa Clara also did a 10-year project of increasing salaries for women's work pay based on the union negotiations and pressure and so on. And so between the two largest city, the city and the county, the two largest public jurisdictions, then the other cities and counties in our area have either had projects or have used the fact that our salaries are higher to raise their salaries for their women's work jobs. And so eventually there are situations where perhaps a clerical classification is out of line with the market, and or their jobs have changed significantly with computers, and they're able to reclassify and therefore increase salaries that way, which has somewhat the same effect as doing it on the basis of comparable worth, but they're actually comparing it with other similar jobs in the jurisdictions around here and with the job that they used to do, but upgrading their classification to get a higher salary. So those kinds of things have increased salaries for women's work jobs, but it hasn't been on the basis of a concerted comparable worth comparison of jobs updating of the hay study and that kind of thing. And that's also true in the county. The county may have gotten closer to actual equal salaries, but I've never been able to really analyze that. And they now are far enough from the study that was done in the county that they probably also need to review it and may find that the thing that happens if you don't actually have the equal salaries at some point, then when you do general salary increases that are based on a percentage increase, the higher paid jobs get more additional money than the lower paid jobs get added to their salaries. It's the same percentage of their salaries, but the money is different, and therefore the higher paid jobs pull away from the lower paid jobs' salary levels, and you get a gap appearing, even if they got to be fairly close. Mm-hmm. And over a period of time, which it certainly has been now, there can very well be significant differences in salaries from with classifications that actually at one point might have been fairly close together. That's a long-term project look that so far there have been major other concerns, whether it's layoffs or the large increases in health insurance mm-hmm. premiums that have interfered with being able to set a priority on looking at the current situation of as far as comparable work in the city and the county.
Right. Were you ever asked by the International Union or other locals to help with comparable work efforts in other locations?
I think other people may have been. The only thing that I remember personally, one or two of us from the library who were involved in the negotiating team spoke at Library Association meetings in California and in Oregon, and also at the American Library Association, along with other people talking about the subject of comparable worth and pay equity and reporting on the strike, along with Eleanor Holmes Norton at one point at an ALA panel. That was good. And also the business agent and the MEF president at the time of the strike, and people who'd been on the Hay Study Committee, I think, were the ones who would have been asked to talk or meet with people in other jurisdictions, and I don't know the details of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Looking back almost 30 years now, how do you assess the legacy of this campaign for comparable worth? Would you consider it a success? I know you're involved with the Coalition for Equal Pay. What challenges still exist, and what role do you think labor has in addressing those challenges? That's
a
lot.
Think labor has a major role in the future, as well as what's been done in the past, because the unions negotiate with the employers to set the salaries, and there really is not a way other than for individuals to negotiate in other non-union situations. So I think this is a very important issue, and to a certain extent, one of the reasons I'm involved in the single-payer healthcare movement is to not only to get coverage for people and to get vision and dental coverage for myself improved and so on, but also because it is such a problem. Healthcare coverage is such a problem for unions in negotiating other kinds of improvements. And one of the reasons that after I retired, I wanted to keep working on this issue. And so I worked with another person, and we founded the Coalition for Equal Pay in our county, in our area. And we worked to help with public awareness and education through using Equal Pay Day, which is a national day that is designated and led by the National Committee on Pay Equity, which is made up of a lot of unions, and including AFSCME, and also women's professions women's work professions and other women's organizations, AAUW, etc., at the national level, and then encouraging their local chapters to work together so they're part of our Coalition for Equal Pay, organizations and individuals, of course, too. And so we've done annual media events for almost 10 years, and then in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of attention nationally and in the media to the question of comparable worth and better enforcement of equal pay for equal work as well, which is a big part of the overall women's wage gap problem. And we have not felt that we needed to try to get media attention here locally because there is a lot of attention already, both through email and through the media. So what we've been doing is to continue a project that we had started, which involves working with high school teachers and now also community college teachers, to provide them with a focus for a lesson on the women's wage gap, including comparable worth as well as the other causes, including not enough women in non-traditional jobs, as well as unequal pay for equal work, etc. And what we do is we cut a piece out of a cookie and put it in a sandwich bag and put a little note with it and inside another bag and tie it up with a ribbon. And we provide these free to teachers so that they can use them to help focus the students' attention, which it does very effectively. We also give them an information folder, a single sheet folded three parts. Six sides, six panels of information. And I realized this year that not only does it focus the students' attention, but it also gets the teachers to make a commitment to do this lesson. So we feel that it's a very effective, the most effective thing that we've done, and we're reaching hundreds and hundreds of high school and community college students this way over several years, and we'll continue to do that. So that's the main thing that I do, and I keep trying to see when it will be a time when both I have the focus and the unions are receptive enough that I can try to encourage other people who are interested to focus on comparable worth again in the city of San Jose and the county of Santa Clara, because I have a connection with the unions in both of those situations, since I'm now a member of the county union because I'm working for the county library.
Right. And how do you think the recent Lilly Ledbetter law and the bill that's in Congress now, do you think they'll help with this issue?
Yes. The Lilly Ledbetter situation, of course, did not make progress. It only took care of a major problem that the Supreme Court created when they changed the rules to say that people needed to file a complaint within 6 months, 180 days of the first discriminatory paycheck, not the last one, which is the sensible thing that has been used for decades, but the first one, when most people don't even have an idea that they're getting discriminated against. And they want to, when they do find out, they want to try to deal with it some other way other than complaining to EEOC first. So the Supreme Court created a problem in the spring of 2007, and Justice Ginsburg said that Congress should deal with this and make it clear so that and eventually they did. And it was wonderful that President Obama was able to sign that bill as the first law that he signed after coming into office. So that helped a huge amount with public attention. But people probably think that was making progress, and it really wasn't making progress. What will make progress is the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is to strengthen the Equal Pay Act and its enforcement and education and penalties and so on and so forth. And that has already passed the House of Representatives once and is, or twice, I guess now, twice, and has passed this year as well. And the problem, of course, is in the Senate, so fortunately, we have now one more Democrat in the Senate who will probably be very helpful on this issue, and yet there are a lot of other things they're working on, and I don't know what the timing plan is on that now. But that is in regard to equal pay for equal work, and it doesn't have to do with comparable worth. The bill in Congress that's been reintroduced many times over the last decade or two that deals with comparable worth is the Fair Pay Act, and that is to clarify that the Equal Pay Act of 1963 and possibly some other laws since then do include the concept of, do at least now after they pass this bill, include the concept of comparable worth. So once we get the Paycheck Fairness Act passed, then we can really begin educating again about comparable worth and its effect on salaries and the income of families and the respect that there is or is not for women's work and the salary adjustments that are needed and the methods that can be used to do those appropriately.
Great. Well, I think we got through all my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add that hasn't been covered? I know you've been interviewed a number of times in the past about this issue. Is there anything that hasn't gotten out there about the story that you wanted to say?
I don't think so. I think with the example of Minnesota, it really helps. Plus, because that is a comprehensive handling of the situation, which included union negotiations and which is ongoing, that they have to review their situation and report periodically every 2 or 3 years and indicate how they're going to deal with any problems or inequities that have been shown in their review. So between that, the fact that there are across the country here and there a lot of jurisdictions, states and otherwise, who have looked at the issue, at least done some kind of look at it and analysis of their situation, perhaps some of them have done some salary adjustments, and also the fact that around the world there has been work on this in Australia, in Canada, all the provinces except for British Columbia have laws that require paying attention to women's work salaries compared with men's work salaries and dealing with that. There was a strike that lasted in British Columbia at the Vancouver Library that lasted for 80 days.
Wow.
A couple years ago, that was about comparable worth, and they were not successful. I hope that they are able to continue to work on it, to work on it again, or to help with getting legislation in British Columbia so that will help them. But apparently that's a very difficult thing to get done there, and that's why it hasn't happened yet. There also was a Greater Victoria Public Library, I think, like a suburban area library that had some studies done and that had not been able to get any success in negotiating, and they were dealing with this right around, again, around the time of the strike in Vancouver, and were able to, I believe, to make some progress on getting some of their salary adjustments implemented. So there are people around the world, undoubtedly other places also that I don't know about, working on this. And it's just that in the United States, we've had a period where during the Clinton administration, there was attention paid to this, but we weren't able to make much progress. And then, of course, we had the years since then when we were definitely not able to make any progress. And now we're looking forward to step-by-step working on it again, along with a lot of other problems that are around, including wars and the healthcare situation and all the other things that really do take a focus and make it difficult to focus on this, especially when here in our area things are not as bad as they are places where there has not been any work done. So it makes it difficult for us to make it a priority when there are other major problems and our comparable worst problem is not as great as it is places where no work has been done on it.
Right. Do you know when the Minnesota program went into effect?
The thing that comes to mind is something like 1987.
Okay.
It's some aspect of it, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Great. Well, I think that's about it. I really appreciate your help.
Well, I appreciate being able to talk about it, obviously.
Yeah. I think this will be a big tool for researchers. As I think I mentioned in one of our emails, I don't know when this will be able to be transcribed.
Right.
But at least we have the audio for now. And, yeah, I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you very much for your work on this.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, too.